it's time to read the Des Moines Register for Friday, the 16th of February, 2024. I'm Dave Buzik, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb Martin. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. For this first hour, we'll cover local and national news, and there's a lot of it, from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. Then we'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners just like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Let's take a look at some snowy weather conditions around the state this morning. The National Weather Service's light snow will be ending over central Iowa early this morning while lingering into mid to late morning over far southern Iowa. Additional accumulations will generally be less than an inch. And I would say while out shoveling in Des Moines this morning, we had a good 4 inches at least in the northwest part of Des Moines where I live. Checking KCCI's news app this morning, Des Moines traffic is slowed today after the snow leads to slick roads and crashes. The Friday morning commute in central Iowa was slowed considerably after snow covered many roads and interstates in the Des Moines area. Westbound traffic on Interstate 80 near DeSoto was completely blocked shortly before 7 a.m. Friday due to a multi-vehicle crash. The crash led to standstill traffic. Traffic on Interstate 235 northbound near Euclid also slowed as traffic was cut off in one lane due to a crash with an injury, according to Des Moines police. Most roads in the state are partially or fully covered. Visibility was also impacted for many drivers throughout the state. So, let's be careful out there as we had a nice respite from all the cold and snow and we're back still in winter conditions. Here's the forecast specifically for Des Moines and central Iowa. Snow expected for the morning. Partly sunny afternoon with blustery winds. High around 32 today. Winds out of the north at 10 to 15. Tonight, mostly clear. Low around 14. We haven't had temperatures down that low in a while. Winds northwest at 10 to 15. Saturday will be mostly sunny, a high near 37, winds out of the west-northwest at 10 to 25. Saturday night, mostly clear, low 25. Sunday, mostly sunny, high up near 48. That sounds pretty nice. And then on Monday, mostly cloudy, slight chance of rain or snow, a high of 54 degrees. So, Barb, hello, nice to see you. Let's take a look at what's happening in the news.
Good to have you back. House, Senate unveil rival AEA bills. And this is written by Galen Bakiri and Stephen Gruber-Miller. Iowa House Republicans unveiled a new plan Wednesday that would retain Iowa's area education agencies as the sole provider of K-12 special education services. Hours later, Senate Republicans released their own, which would allow school districts to take the lion's share of current AEA money and use it at their discretion for special education and other services. The changes create a pair of dueling proposals that both rewrite one of Governor Kim Reynolds' key priorities ahead of a Friday legislative deadline. Reynolds has received widespread pushback on her plan to allow school districts to choose whether to rely on the state's 9 AEAs for special education services or contract with another provider. Some of that resistance has come from her own party. Earlier this month, House Republican lawmakers refused to advance her bill through a subcommittee hearing while Senate lawmakers moved the bill forward, while acknowledging that they'd like to see significant changes. House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican, New Hartford, said that his members heard Iowans' concern about changes to special education. Quote, "We wanted to provide certainty for special education," he said. "And we took Iowans' feedback that we've been having in our meetings and realized how important that was. And we feel that our plan provides that certainty into the future when it comes to special education." The House GOP proposal, House Study Bill 713, lays out a 3-year timeline in which school districts will be permitted, starting in the 25-26 school year, to look for outside contractors to provide media services and general education services. Special education services would remain solely the jurisdiction of the AEAs. Reynolds provided a one-sentence statement Wednesday in response to the House bill. I appreciate that we will be able to continue the conversation, she said. Senate Republicans released their plan through a committee amendment later Wednesday night, advancing the new version to the floor. Their proposal would, starting in 2025, redirect 90% of money sent to the AEAs for special education services and 60% of money for general education and media services to local districts instead of the AEAs themselves. The districts would use those dollars to determine whether to continue contracting with the AEAs for those services or to seek other avenues. Unlike the House bill, districts are not required to remain contracted with AEAs for special education services. Democrats have strongly resisted Reynolds' proposed changes to the AEAs. House Minority Leader Jennifer Confist, Democrat of Windsor Heights, said that Republicans shouldn't play politics with the AEAs. Quote, the people who seem to be forgotten sometimes in this political battle are the kids who need services, she says. So House Democrats will be continuing to focus on those kids and those services, not the political games that we are being played during the session. Senate Democrats echoed that sentiment in committee Wednesday night. We've all heard from those same people, and we know that they want this dropped, said Senator Molly Donahue, Democrat, Cedar Rapids. They want their schools to have these services. House Republicans' plan would differ from Reynolds' proposal in several key ways. First of all, the House bill would continue sending all federal special education dollars directly to the AEAs rather than to individual school districts, as Reynolds proposed. Also, the state aid and property tax dollars that currently go to AEAs would go to school districts under the House bill. But districts would be required to continue using AEAs for special education services. When the plan is implemented, schools could choose whether to continue contracting with AEAs for media services and general education services under a fee-for-service structure, or they could choose to get those services from a private provider. And also, none of those changes will take effect until 2025-26 school year under the House plan. Reynolds' bill would make changes beginning with the upcoming school year this fall. And also, Reynolds' bill would have implemented a $35 million property tax cut by axing the money that AEAs receive for media services. The House bill keeps that money, but sends it to school districts. We know the timeline was a big deal, how quickly it was moving, Grassley said. And this gets us out to the 2025 school year before there's really any true change in the school district level, at that level. And Grassley said that he'd briefed the governor, House lawmakers, and AEAs on the new plan and pledged to continue having conversations to make further changes. He said his caucus's new plan to implement changes gradually would allow for districts and agencies to better prepare. I think this plan keeps that path moving forward, but at the same time recognizing that trying to implement something over the next few months was probably an unachievable goal for our school districts to be able to do so, Grassley said. The bill also creates a task force to make recommendations on AEA properties, services, oversight, and staffing by the end of 2024. House Republicans were trying to fast-track the bill through the committee process alongside new caucus plans to address teacher pay and school funding ahead of Friday's first legislative funnel deadline. Confish first said that she'd rather see lawmakers gather more data before making any changes to the AEAs. We continue to reject the premise that AEAs needed wholesale change and to be overhauled, she said. So we're going to be looking very closely to see what the impact will be on the kids in rural communities who need mental health services and special education services. At a subcommittee hearing For the plan Thursday, advocates and education groups called it an improvement, but emphasized that they'd have to see further changes, such as allowing shared operations and employees between districts and AEAs, and including crisis intervention services. And several people hesitated at the scope of authority the education director would have under the bill, warning that it could undercut region-specific services and requests. Quote, the schools should be able to determine what services they need and respect those services without having to fear that there's going to be a rejection of that budget, as well as positions being lost, said Heather Sievers of Altoona, whose child has used AE Special Education Services. Reynolds has touted her plan to overhaul AEAs as a necessary move to trim down what she has characterized as too large institutions with high costs, excessive staffing, and wide-ranging duties. She has also said Iowa special education students are lagging their peers around the nation in educational outcomes. But her proposal, even after an amendment, proved unpopular among some lawmakers and many educators and families who receive AEA services. While her plan has cautiously advanced in the Senate last month, a House subcommittee declined to do the same, citing a need for further conversations. David's going to continue here.
Rather long story, so we're splitting it up. Continuing on, the Senate plan, outlined by Senator Lynn Evans, a Republican from Orillia, would send a majority of the dollars currently provided to AEAs directly to school districts instead. Starting in fiscal year 2025, 90% of funding dedicated to special education services would be sent to districts who can use that money to decide whether they remain contracted with the AEA for special education or seek another provider. The remaining 10% of that money would go to the AEAs. Districts would receive 60% of money currently sent to AEAs for media and general education services, also giving school boards the choice whether to remain with the AEA or another provider. AEAs would receive the other 40% of that money. The bill continues to say for fiscal year 2024, AEAs would still receive all of their allocated special education funding and money for professional development services. Those professional development service dollars would remain with the AEAs going forward. Under this plan, districts are not obligated to remain under contract with the AEAs for special education or any other services, unlike the House plan. Under the Senate plan, districts would decide annually by February 1st whether they wish to contract with the AEA for special education services. Representative Evans said, quote, let's allow our AEA directors to come up with solutions on becoming more efficient and more effective. They've asked for that time. We're giving it to them with this amendment. He emphasized that further changes were almost certainly coming before floor debate on the proposal. But Democrats expressed extensive frustration with the altered proposal. Senator Sarah Trone Garriott, a Democrat from West Des Moines, was concerned the split in funding would create gaps in critical services, particularly among rural districts. Senator Trone Garriott said, I'm very concerned that this split of 40-60 might mean they just don't have the resources to be out there supporting our state. House Republicans are also scaling back Governor Reynolds' pitch for a new division of special education within the Department of Education. Reynolds has proposed hiring 139 people to staff the division and has already begun posting job openings despite the fact that lawmakers have not passed the bill. Those positions would be funded under Reynolds' plan by shifting $20 million in funding from the AEAs into the regular state budget. The House GOP proposal would not eliminate AEA jobs, but would add 5 state employees per each AEA for the new Division of Special Education. Those employees would be stationed around the state with another 13 employees based in Des Moines. Speaker Grassley said, we're not trying to build the bureaucracy here in Des Moines from the standpoint of just more people to have more people. We want to have accountability through people out in the field working with our schools and our AEAs. The House bill would also limit the pay for the 9 AEA administrators a source of criticism from Republicans by capping their salary at the average salary of school superintendents within the AEA's boundary. Republicans in the Iowa House are also tweaking Reynolds' plan to raise teacher pay in Iowa and planning to send more money for districts to use for salaries or other spending at their discretion. Under the House plan, House Study Bill 714, starting salary for a first-year teacher would be $47,500 for 1 year before raising to $50,000 in the second year. Iowa's minimum starting salary for a teacher currently is $33,500. Grassley said the two-year phase-in was in response to school districts expressing concern about managing their budgets while bumping up the rest of the salary scale in response to a starting pay increase. Grassley said, "We want to make sure school districts have time to implement that and make adjustments internally with the changes we made." Reynolds' plan would have set the minimum starting salary at $50,000 and also raised the minimum pay for teachers with at least 12 years of experience to $62,000. House Republicans' plan does not include the raise for teachers with 12 years of experience. The House bill also includes $14 million to allow schools to pay a minimum wage of $15 an hour to other school employees who are not salaried. To pay for the teacher salary increases, Grassley said House Republicans propose a 3% increase in state supplemental aid to school districts, about $25 million more than the 2.5% increase that Reynolds has proposed. Confers, the leader of the House Democrats, said Democrats continue to welcome Republicans to the cause of teacher pay. She said she was glad to see the pay increase separated from the AEA bill. Confers said, "I think it was politics to put teacher pay in the AEA bill, so I'm glad to see that the House has separated those two things out."
Highly paid Polk County supervisors give themselves a 16th annual raise. And this is Virginia Barita. Despite dissenting votes, the Polk County Board of Supervisors have decided to give itself another pay raise, just like it has every year for at least the past 16 years. The 4% raise also will go to the rest of the county government's elected officials. It is set to take effect in the fiscal year that begins in July. The 3-2 vote Tuesday with members Steve Van Oort and Matt McCoy opposed will hike the supervisors' salaries to $149,290 from $143,548. The Polk County supervisors' pay already was the highest for a county board in Iowa and well in excess of those for boards in similar-sized Midwestern counties, the compensation panel used for comparison. They also eclipse Governor Reynolds' $130,000 annual pay. The highest paid Polk official will continue to be County Attorney Kimberly Graham, with an annual salary of $255,136. The vote followed a unanimous recommendation by the Polk County Compensation Board, which said the across-the-board raise for elected officials is needed to keep up with inflation. County employees in Teamsters Local 238 and AFSCME Local 1868 are getting a 4% increase as well, based on negotiated contracts through 2027, according to information provided by the Compensation Board. Now, elected officials in the county have received raises every fiscal year since 2010-11, including an increase of 6% for county supervisors last year, the largest in a decade. On average, the supervisors have received a nearly 3.7% bump in salary annually over the past decade, a period when the salaries for many Americans were stagnant. Van Oort told the Des Moines Register he voted against the raise because the county needs to hold the line, adding that he didn't think constituents would appreciate the pay increase. In Polk County, the Board of Supervisors meets about twice a month to consider the act upon official county business and approve staff appointments, according to the county's website. It also holds work sessions every week where it consults with staff and discusses future agendas. The board's most important power is its ability to set the county budget, through which it monitors and corrects inefficiencies in all county departments, according to the website. All board members who are considered full-time employees should be available to their constituents on a full-time basis. And in addition to the five supervisors in Graham, Polk's elected officials are the sheriff, treasurer, recorder, and auditor. They receive health, dental, and vision insurance and mileage reimbursement. They also are eligible to participate in the county's deferred compensation program, which bolsters their savings for retirement and includes a contribution from the county, according to an employee manual for county elected officials. The compensation board, made up of representatives of each of the elected officers, as well as two for the supervisors, voted to recommend the 4% raise in a meeting in late January. A transcript shows that a few of the members expressed concern for the 4% hike and that it was too small. Jennifer Galloway, a board member representing Graham, said that she was hoping for a 4.5%, which would be closer to last year's amount, adding even with that increase, the county attorney's pay fell short of that of the Des Moines City attorney. County Administrator John Norris, however, told the board the county could face a $4 million to $5 million shortfall in the next 2 years, which he blamed on state legislation last year that imposed sweeping property tax cuts, reining in local government's revenue growth. Norris added, and that could get worse. Joseph Quinn, an attorney representing the supervisors, proposed the 4% raise that the board ultimately approved, saying that it was in line with inflation this year, which is down from last year's. Just seems to me it'd be a good number, essentially something lower than what we did last year, but I thought something in line with cost of living, Quinn told the board. After Graham, Sheriff Kevin Schneider will be the next highest earner among county elected officials in the coming fiscal year, receiving $212,300, and the county auditor, recorder, and treasurer, like the supervisors, will each make $149,290. According to the latest data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the average national wage rose 2.8% from June of 22 to July of 23, and over the last 12 months, the Consumer Price Index, which measures the average change in prices paid by consumers for a representative basket of goods, rose 3.1%. For the fifth year in a row, all elected officials' salaries in Polk County will exceed that of the governor, whose salary is capped by the Iowa legislature at $130,000. The state attorney general's salary is $123,669, and the secretary of state, auditor, treasurer, and lieutenant governor earn $103,212, according to compensation board information. Among elected board officials in the peer Midwestern counties that the compensation panel considered, the highest paid was the chair of the county board in Kane County, Illinois, who receives $105,328. The board's 24 part-time members get $26,000. A suburb of Chicago, Kane County has a population of 514,182, compared with Polk County's 501,089, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Now, the highest paid elected official in Kane is the sheriff, who makes $163,200 and is projected to get a 2% salary increase in the 2024-5 fiscal year. It's not possible to compare pay for Illinois county attorneys, called state's attorneys, who are compensated differently. Also receiving six-figure salaries were the full-time county commissioners in Sedgwick County, Kansas, home of Wichita, and Ramsey County, Minnesota, a Minneapolis suburb. Though at $104,572 and $101,280, respectively, they are paid about 25% to 30% less than the Polk County supervisor. In Douglas County, Nebraska, population 586,327, the home of Omaha, the seven part-time county commissioners receive $61,310 per year. As in Polk County, the Douglas County Attorney is the highest paid elected official, making $234,200, and is projected to get a 3.5% raise in the upcoming fiscal year. The lowest paid board members on the list of peer counties were the 37 part-time supervisors in Dane County, Wisconsin, population 568,200, the home of Madison, who make just $11,423 apiece. Dave?
And we normally don't do sports until the second hour, but we have to read this story about Caitlin Clark's amazing performance last night in Iowa City. Headline, Iowa star Caitlin Clark dazzles, as only she knows how, on a record-setting night. This story by Dargan Southard of the Des Moines Register. Dateline, Iowa City. In the building and across the country, everyone knew what was coming, and still, she stunned us all. Needing 8 points to break the NCAA women's basketball scoring record entering last night's sold-out showdown against the University of Michigan, Caitlin Clark likely wasn't going to need much time to morph this night into something marvelous. A few shots, perhaps. A quarter at most, maybe. Then Clark did what she does, dazzling beyond belief. The Iowa star needed a mere 3 shots and barely 2 minutes to ignite a Carver-Hawkeye Arena eruption louder than any other during this remarkable season. Part of a legendary 23-point first quarter and a 49-point performance for the game that compelled No. 4 Iowa to a win over Michigan 106-89. Clark said, who usually casually set a new career high and Iowa single-game scoring record in the process, she said, I don't know if you could have really scripted it any better. No kidding. After a driving layup and then a deep three-point shot to kick off this memorable affair, it was Clark that was ready to take care of business instantly. Gabby Marshall corralled a loose ball and hit a sprinting Clark perfectly in transition, the Carver-Hawkeye Arena crowd building toward the ultimate crescendo. Even with the Tiger Hawk's edge of the logo barely one dribble past half court, range that she has normalized better than any other college basketball player, Clark launched the record-clinching heave, and everybody held their breath and waited for the swish. Clark said, I thought about doing it a couple of possessions earlier, but I was a little tired. I needed to catch my breath a little bit. I stepped back to my left a little bit and was able to get it off. It went in, and we all celebrated. Honestly, I thought Coach Lisa Bluter was going to call timeout, she said, before I had to go play defense. But she didn't, so I had to go play defense. But honestly, when I was warming up, my shot just felt good, so I knew it was going to be one of those nights. When that timeout was called, Clark's teammates wasted zero time matching the moment. The entire roster came charging off the bench to meet Clark at half court during the timeout, then watched as their superstar friend absorbed the energy she created. Excuse me. Hug then came from every member of the Iowa coaching staff, starting with the woman who believed in Clark the most. Without the ample trust established between Clark and Coach Lisa Bluter, a scene like Thursday does not come close to materializing. Coach Bluter said, the University of Iowa is the right place for this to happen. It absolutely is. This is a place that has supported women's basketball for such a long time. Anything can happen here. We show it over and over again. Iowa, she said, is a special place. A special place for a special player who wasn't stopping anytime soon. The opening act to Clark's riveting performance featured 5 trays and just 2 misses on 10 attempts, along with a steady stream of noise that rarely relented in the arena. By the time everyone could take a breath after 10 chaotic minutes, Clark had produced the second highest scoring quarter of her decorated career. While Michigan proved a bit uncooperative early on this unforgettable evening, Iowa eventually corralled the extra energy and used it for a runaway rout. The Hawkeyes first went up double figures in the second quarter, enlarged that to 12 at the break, and kept things on cruise control for the bulk of the second half. The Wolverines got within 10 points once in the third quarter, but never generated any serious upset tension. Michigan, being barely visible in the rearview mirror, was all Clark needed to keep thriving. Her full arsenal was on display all the way through, With 13 assists and 5 rebounds, Clark's smile widening with every addition to the career highlight reel. She said, "Obviously, getting this record is tremendous and has to be celebrated. But there have been so many people to come before me who laid such a great foundation for women's basketball. That needs to be celebrated, too." She said, "I'm just very thankful for that." She went on to say, "We're getting into the best part of basketball season. These are the times where your team really, really shows who they are. I always believe Coach Bluder has us playing our best basketball at the end of February, beginning of March. I really think we are. You lose a game here and there, but that's what makes you learn and get better. Iowa basketball is at such a high right now, and it's so fun to watch. People love supporting it, just trying to enjoy every second because this team is special." Of course, Clark's supporting cast wasn't going to miss the moment either. Another quiet 20-point effort from Kate Martin accentuated her value as Clark's top wing woman. 13 points from Hannah Stulke, 2 bounce-back trays from Gabby Marshall, and an important return from Molly Davis, who's been out ill, capped a productive Iowa evening from start to finish. That cavalcade of Hawkeyes was weaved in perfectly to Clark's post-game ceremony, which included confetti, an emotional tribute video, countless hugs, and even a few tears. Chants of "one more year" serenaded Clark as she began her usual kid-friendly autograph session. Potentially, there are just a few more weeks left in Clark's mind-blowing college career that has redefined what is possible in the college basketball world. If Thursday was any indication, Clark has something magnificent scheduled for what's ahead.
Well, it's all downhill from there. But I will tell you, the Auditor Sand says that the GOP is again trying to strip him of his power. Okay, Iowa Republicans want to allow state agencies to outsource their annual audits, proposing a bill that State Auditor Rob Sand's office is calling a political play to undermine Iowa's sole statewide elected Democrat. Senate File 2311, which moved through a subcommittee and committee Wednesday, a day after being introduced, would permit departments to fulfill their annual audit obligations by employing a certified public accountant to perform the audit and submitting the results to the auditor of state. Republicans called the proposal a common-sense solution to an increasingly short-staffed field in Iowa, arguing that state agencies should, quote, "accountants believe that they have a high ethical standard and can deliver this and would deliver it well with the flexibility that would bring efficiency and effectiveness to state government as well," says Senator Mike Bousselot, Republican of Ankeny and sponsor of the bill. John McCormally, Sand's chief of staff, outlined the auditor's office's total opposition to the bill in testimony Wednesday. The office believes that the legislation overturns the will of the voters by going around the auditor's office, and it could lead to agencies seeking more compliant and less invasive audits, would drive up the costs on the taxpayers, and does not protect whistleblowers. Quote, "This is a recipe for corruption," McCormally said. "It's really easy to get away with things when you have the ref on the team." He pushed back on Bousselot's comparison to local and school audits, emphasizing that those audits were still subject to further review. The proposal comes a year after the legislature passed a bill curbing Sands' investigative powers and barring him from taking another statewide office to court to enforce a document subpoena. Bousselot said, who also led the last year's bill, disagreed with the auditor's office about whether the auditor's office would be able to review outside accountants' audits once that they have been submitted. He replied, "Yes," but McCormally said that was simply not true, later citing language in the bill that he says would likely bar the office from re-auditing or overseeing submitted audits. Marlis Gaston, who formerly worked in the auditor's office, told lawmakers the bill would likely also prevent the auditor's office from releasing an opinion on the whole state after annual audits are conducted. For one to be issued, extra work would be required to receive financial statements and issue separate opinions on individual departments. You're increasing the cost exponentially by doing that, Gaston said. McCormely said that although the auditor's office had yet to do a full analysis of the cost, he estimated the process would cost upwards to $5 million. Senator Tony Bisignano, Democrat of Des Moines, decried the legislation as bad business and neutering of the auditor's office. We will have one Democrat elected statewide, one, Bisignano said. And he's the auditor, unfortunately for you, because he's the guy that can look in to see what the rest of you are doing. That seems to be a problem here now. In a committee vote Wednesday evening, one Republican joined the Democrats in voting against the bill, which advanced. Senator Charlie McClintock, Republican of Alburnett, told the Register that he found the bill unnecessary. I think the process that we have in place is good, where the auditor comes in and makes the audits at the state level, especially, McCormick said.
Also on the front page of today's Des Moines Register, mental health overhaul bill advances in the Iowa House. This story by Michaela Rahm and Galen Bacarrier. Governor Kim Reynolds' plan to overhaul Iowa's fractured mental health and disability service systems is advancing at the Iowa Capitol. The 80-page bill, introduced to the legislature last week, lays out the Republican governor's plan to reshape mental health and substance abuse treatment services offered in Iowa, merging 32 local regions into 7 new unified districts. House Study Bill 653 would also move disability services currently overseen by those local regions, instead shifting that management to the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services. Lawmakers and state officials have described the new proposal as the next step in Reynolds' massive reorganization of state government signed into law last year. The proposed legislation has much to do with our reorganization as well as our continued momentum in wanting to make the best mental health and disability services available for all Iowans, according to Representative Joel Fry, a Republican from Osceola, during a House subcommittee hearing last week. With Iowa agencies officially consolidated and in effect, Iowa Department of Health and Human Services Director Kelly Garcia said that focus has now shifted to the arms of the agency that manage the array of services offered by the state of Iowa. The plan was advanced through committee on Wednesday and awaits floor debate in the House, having survived the first funnel deadline of this session. The governor's office, Health and Human Services, and other supporters of the bill say the consolidation effort is a necessary step to address issues within Iowa's current system, which they say separates substance abuse treatments and mental health services. Services are not consistent across the current system, creating gaps in Iowans' ability to access the care they need. That's according to Molly Severn, legislative liaison and deputy chief of staff for Governor Reynolds' office. And she said that during last week's House subcommittee hearing. As a result, Iowans are not able to access behavioral health services where they live and when they need them, she said. With this shift, officials can establish a truly integrated, equitable system of behavioral health care for the first time, said Iowa HHS spokesperson Alex Murphy in a prepared statement. Murphy went on to write, "Right now, the way mental health and disability services regions are structured, Iowans have to know which region they reside in, which services are funded in their region, and who the service providers are. The newly aligned system will be well coordinated with clear access points so Iowans can receive the same behavioral health services across the state no matter where they live," end quote. Both the House and Senate versions of the bill have passed committee vote and are eligible for full debate before both chambers. Senator Jeff Edler, a Republican from State Center who chaired the subcommittee on the Senate version of the legislation, Senate File 2354, said he supports moving the bill forward, although he expects lawmakers to offer an amendment when it comes up before the full Senate. Edler said, I would like to say thank you also. This has been a continuation of an ongoing journey, and we've got to keep moving forward to close those gaps. Currently, Iowa has 13 mental health and disability service regions that oversee mental health and disability services, as well as 19 integrated provider networks that manage substance abuse and problem gambling services. Governor Reynolds' proposal would dissolve that system, instead establishing a new behavioral health service system made up of 7 districts to oversee services for those with mental health conditions and substance abuse disorders. Reynolds said in a prepared statement, 25% of adults with serious mental health challenges also suffer from substance abuse disorder. But right now, the system is fractured, preventing Iowans from getting the support they need. Reynolds said by aligning these 32 separate regions into a unified 7, we can improve coordination of services and deliver better treatment for Iowans. The governor's proposal outlines the new system's duties, including prevention services, evidence-based early intervention and treatment, support services designed to avoid needing acute care or law enforcement, and crisis services focused on de-escalation. HHS would be tasked with maintaining a central data repository to track the new system and its impacts, and to use that data to track behavioral health needs, develop policies, and otherwise perform acts as necessary to enhance the state's overall behavioral health. The new bill directs HHS to hire an Administrative Services Organization, or an ASO, to oversee each of the 7 districts and its service array. Kelly Garcia, who runs Iowa HHS, said, "As we move forward, our Administrative Service Organization structure is key. That's the accountability mechanism," she says. "It's also the space where we ensure that local input is there." These ASOs could come in the form of a dedicated regional administrator or a public or private agency already operating within the bounds of the new health district. HHS would seek proposals for potential candidates for those organizational roles. Severn told lawmakers, "The contracts with these entities will have a budget and a measurable outcome and performance measures." The new district's boundaries would be determined based on city and county lines, areas of high need, population, and the patterns of those populations when seeking and receiving care. Each district would also have a 9-person advisory council, the members of which would be appointed by the ASO. The council would be made up of 3 elected officials, 3 behavioral health care providers, and 3 individuals receiving behavioral health services or with lived experience. These advisory boards will establish individualized behavioral health plans for their district based on local need. Severn added that maintaining local autonomy and establishing these core services is a critical part of the new proposal. So how would these districts be funded? HHS would allocate funding to each of the 7 districts through a behavioral health fund, which would function similar to a block grant. Dollars to that fund would come from the state's general budget and would be calculated using the state's total population. Currently, mental health and disability service regions rely on state funding, but spending is determined by local governing boards. As a result, spending decisions on services to Iowans is not consistent across the state, leading to gaps for patients and providers. The state estimates the regions have $23 million unspent dollars in its incentive fund balance, despite there being a growing need for behavioral health services, with millions more projected to come in over the coming years. So what happens to the current disability services? Under the proposal, disability services currently provided by Iowa's 13 mental health and disability service regions would be shifted to the state's aging and disability services under Iowa HHS. The agency is directed to establish a coordinated system of aging and disability resource centers that oversee long-term living or community support services for Iowans with disabilities. According to the bill, that includes those with chronic mental illness, intellectual disability, developmental disability, or a brain injury. When would this transition take place? The new behavioral health service system would be operational by July 1 of 2025. If the legislation is approved and signed into law, the effort to overhaul the state's mental health and disability service systems would begin July 1st of this year. How have Iowa's behavioral health districts changed before? Well, Reynolds' plan this session is not the first time the state has changed how behavioral health services are managed in Iowa. Services were controlled on a county-by-county basis until 2014, when they were consolidated into 32 local regions that serve as the current system. 19 of those regions are dedicated to substance abuse services, and 13 provide mental health services. Dollars for that system were funded by county property taxes and managed by regional authority until 2021, when Reynolds signed a sweeping tax law that eliminated that property tax levy and instead shifted mental health funding to the state's general fund. What have Republicans and Democrats said about this new plan? Republicans have praised the proposal to overhaul the state's mental health and substance abuse services, saying the latest legislation continues after years of effort of Iowa's highest offices to improve access to behavioral health services. This quote is to Fry, and I have to look back and see who Fry is. Hang on one second, because I think he was mentioned very early in this story. Well, I'm assuming he's a member of the legislature, a Republican member of the legislature named Fry. He said, "There's improvement to be made and many opportunities to be gained, but by and large, we are listening to what Iowans are needing, and we look forward to how this bill will also help complement the next step of our mental health and disability service system." Representative Ann Meyer, a Republican from Port Dodge, echoed those comments during the House subcommittee hearing, saying she believes the legislation is a great change. She said, "I know in my district we have people that are not having their needs met, and I'm looking forward to closing those gaps." Democrats so far have been more cautious in signing on to this effort, saying they still have lingering questions about this proposed overhaul. Representative Beth Wessel-Crochel, a Democrat from Ames, said, "It's a big move. I think there's a lot of good things in here, but I do have some questions on some of this stuff. So at this time, I'm going to join the undecided group and continue to work on it." Democratic Senator Sarah Trone Garriott of West Des Moines asked Kelly Garcia if the new plan would allow counties to continue some of the collaborations they're doing now. She raised concerns that counties would lack a voice in determining services under an ASO. Trone Garriott said, "Do you have any plans to help make sure that all those counties have full representation, that they're going to have a voice, that we're not going to lose services that we currently are providing when the transition happens?" Garcia said the plan is still a draft and is intended to ensure that local partnerships can continue if they are working well. Garcia said, "Maps are tricky because folks hone in on this being a boundary and a demarcation or a catchment area. But a reminder that in this new system, there really aren't barriers or walls. It's really more about collaboration," she said.
Gun danger lurks wherever people gather. A Super Bowl victory parade in Kansas City, Missouri, became another joyful celebration marred by gun violence, reminding us, if we ever forgot, that a lurking danger hovers over Americans every time we gather together to celebrate, honor, or commemorate. The chance that a single event might become the scene of violence is relatively small, but tragedy after tragedy has become a part of the national psyche. Some politicians and advocates are again questioning where in America it is truly safe to assemble. This shooting is yet another reminder that no parade, no church, no school, really nowhere at all is safe from America's gun violence crisis, said John Feinblatt, who's president of Every Town for Gun Safety. He said that after Wednesday's shooting. In 2017, a gunman shot more than 11,000 rounds of ammunition at an outdoor county music concert near Las Vegas hotels as fans crouched in terror. 60 people died. In 2022, a man with a rifle fired into a 4th of July parade outside Chicago. Parents frantically ran, some holding their children. 7 died. And now 11 children were shot in the moments after a Super Bowl victory parade Wednesday. Thousands of red-clad fans ran for their lives across the confetti-strewn streets. In total, 22 people suffered gunshot wounds, including one fatally, interim Kansas City Fire Chief Grundison said. Kevin Sanders, 53, of Lenexa, Kansas, summed it up simply, "It sucks that someone had to ruin the celebration," he said after hearing the gunshots in the crowd. Last year, the U.S. experienced 10 fatal public mass shootings that killed 72 people, according to the USA Today Mass Killing Database, a partnership with the Associated Press and Northeastern University. That's the most in a year since tracking began in 2006. I think that's something that all of us who are parents, who are just regular people living each day, have to decide what we wish to do about, said Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas, who attended the parade with his wife and mother and had to run for cover when gunfire broke out. Parades, rallies, schools, movies, it seems like almost nothing is safe, he said. This resonates deeply in a nation that has a long tradition of gathering and celebrating together. Well, what are we waiting for? In Kansas City, more than 800 law enforcement officers were on hand to provide security along the parade route, said Police Chief Stacy Graves. But in a nation awash in guns, it's hard for law enforcement to prevent such attacks. Some leaders and activists say that means the nation needs stricter gun laws in general. Lucas has joined with mayors across the county in calling for new laws to reduce gun violence, including mandating universal background checks for gun buyers. Moms Demand Action Executive Director Angela Farrell Zabala said that the shooting should prompt politicians to tighten gun laws. A Super Bowl victory parade that should have been pure joy became a tragedy for a community, she said. American attitudes toward gun violence seem to be shifting slightly. 6 in 10 adults last year said that gun violence was a very big problem in the country, up 9% points from 2022, according to the Pew Research Center. And almost 2 in 3 said that they expected the level of gun violence to increase over the next 5 years. The Super Bowl, watched this year by more than 1 in 3 Americans, is the most unifying event in America, President Joe Biden said late Wednesday. Nothing brings more of us together, Biden said, and the celebration of a Super Bowl win is a moment that brings a joy that can't be matched to the winning team and their supporters. For this joy to be turned to tragedy today in Kansas City cuts deep in the American soul. Biden called for a ban on assault weapons, limits on high-capacity magazines, and strengthened background checks. Today's events should move us, shock us, shame us into acting, he said. What are we waiting for? What else do we need to see? When the San Francisco 49ers won the Super Bowl in 1982, the city threw a disastrous parade, in part because officials had planned for 25,000 people to attend, and instead 500,000 showed up. It was a case of civic negligence, the San Francisco Chronicle wrote, because police moved part of the parade route to accommodate the crowd, meaning many who had lined up for hours never got to see their team go by. It was the worst parade I ever saw, 49ers fan John Sheridan told the paper. Today, officials must speak to more painful issues. I appreciate the bravery and the coordination of the law enforcement officers, first responders, and healthcare workers for ensuring a swift, orderly evacuation and caring for the victims, Representative Sharice Davis, Democrat of Kansas, wrote on X. The traumatic memories of today will stick with children, families, and community members for far too long, she posted. This does not reflect the spirit of Kansas City, and I suppose those asking for a chance to ensure a brighter and safer future.
And moving to the front page of the Metro and Iowa section today, there are four stories on the front page. Along the right-hand side, Reynolds bill to cut boards advances. On the left, could the Des Moines Metro become a BMX hub? On the bottom, state auditor Rob Sand says the Board of Parole cited a new Republican-backed law to deny him documents. And we'll start with the story across the top of the page. Medical board okays revised abortion rules. A six-week ban is on hold pending a state high court ruling. This story by Michaela Rahm. The Iowa Board of Medicine has approved administrative rules to enact the state's six-week abortion ban, should the courts allow the law to go into effect. On Thursday, Iowa's top medical board unanimously approved revised guidelines for how doctors can comply with the fetal heartbeat law's narrow exceptions for rape, incest, fetal abnormality, or to save the life of the pregnant person. The law bans abortions when cardiac activity can be detected in the pregnancy, which can occur at about 6 weeks. Leif Olson, Chief Deputy Attorney General for the Iowa Attorney General's Office, said during Thursday's meeting, "I know that this was a much longer process than we usually need to follow for rulemaking, but we appreciate all the great input we received from the board and appreciate how we're getting to help our physicians and their patients throughout our state by making things clear for them as we go forward." Iowa Board of Medicine members did make some changes to the guidelines following a public hearing to amend some of the language and to clarify certain requirements for doctors. However, the guidelines requirements largely remain unchanged from the proposed draft rules introduced to the board in November when members began their rulemaking process. Doctors must still meet certain conditions in order to provide an abortion under the law's exceptions, which includes the requirement to gather facts about an alleged rape or incest and to obtain a signed certificate that the information is true. There is still little insight from these rules on what penalties doctors could face if they violate the law, and that's a concerning aspect for those on both sides of the issue. The Board of Medicine's rules now go before the Iowa Legislature's Administrative Rules Committee, which would vote on final approval. If the courts allow the abortion law to go into effect, those rules will then become enforceable by the state's medical board. Iowa's abortion law has not gone into effect due to an ongoing legal challenge from its opponents. Enforcement of the law was blocked by a Polk County District Court judge shortly after the law was signed into effect by Governor Reynolds in July. The Iowa Supreme Court is expected to hear arguments over enforcement of the abortion ban sometime this year, with a decision expected by the end of June. While the new law remains tied up in the courts, abortion remains legal in Iowa up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. So what changes did the board make? The most significant change the Board of Medicine made to the proposed draft rules was on the requirement that doctors obtain certain information to determine whether the pregnancy is the result of rape or incest if cardiac activity is detected. Under the first draft of the rules, doctors would have been required to gather specific details from the patient, including the date the reported rape or incest occurred and the date that act was reported to another party, such as law enforcement or a physician. But board members had expressed concern about these requirements during a meeting in January, stating that this type of information gathering was not within the scope of a typical provider-patient relationship. Opponents to these rules also expressed similar concerns, stating such a requirement could erode trust with patients and force doctors to a legal standard they typically don't need to follow. The Board of Medicine amended the rules to allow physicians to obtain this information from other sources, such as the patient's parent or guardian, and to clarify that the physician is not required to explicitly ask the patient these questions. Olson of the Board of Medicine, actually he's an attorney general, assistant attorney general assigned to the Board of Medicine, said during yesterday's meeting, "The rule does not tell the physician how to obtain the information in response to the board's concerns, that the way it was phrased before made it look like these specific questions that had to be asked of the woman." The new rules also clarify that there's no burden on the patient to verify the information they've been provided is accurate, instead stating the physician may rely on a good faith assessment that the information is true. Those details must be documented in a patient's medical record, according to these new rules. The board also amended the rules language to address concerns they had about specific terminology used in the initial draft. During its January meeting, board members took issue with the rule's use of the term woman, stating physicians would not use that term to describe a minor who had become pregnant. The new rules clarify that woman refers to any female individual regardless of age. The board also requested an edit on the term unborn child, stating last month that it was not an appropriate medical term, and they believed embryo or fetus would be more accurate. The new rules do not eliminate unborn child, but defines that term using medical terminology requested by the board. The new rules also change the method to determine whether cardiac activity is present in a pregnancy. Doctors must use a transabdominal pelvic ultrasound in a manner consistent with standard medical practice. The board did not make any changes to the rules that follow the provision of the law that allows abortion to take place in cases of fetal abnormality incompatible with life. Doctors providing this care in those cases must sign a certificate and document their support of a fetal abnormality, including any tests or procedures to determine that diagnosis and a description of why the abnormality is incompatible with life. It also offered no insight on how doctors can comply with the provision of the 6-week ban that allows abortions to be provided in cases of medical emergency. Some opponents to the law have raised concerns about the uncertainty physicians may face in providing care in these cases, saying that it's unclear at what stage they may intervene. Some have speculated doctors may put off abortions, leading to worse health outcomes for their patients. The board also did not offer any additional insight on the possible penalties that doctors from the Iowa Board of Medicine... There's something missing in this sentence. I think what they mean to say is the board also did not offer any additional insight on possible penalties that the Board of Medicine would impose on doctors. The guidelines simply say failure to comply with the law or the administrative rules may constitute grounds for discipline. The Iowa Board of Medicine is the sole authority in the state to enforce the 6-week abortion ban. Under existing administrative rules, the board has the authority to revoke or suspend a physician's license or impose civil fines up to $10,000, among other disciplinary actions.